This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. This episode is sponsored by a company I've literally been using for over 15 years now, and that is 5.11. Now, my introduction to their products began when I started wearing 5.11 uniforms years ago for Anaheim Fire Department. And since then, I have acquired a host of their backpacks and luggage, which have literally been around the world with me. The backpack where I keep all my recording equipment is a 5.11 backpack. And then most of my civilian gear, the clothes that I wear, are also 5.11. Now, more recently, they've actually branched out into the brick and mortar stores. So, for example, Gainesville, where I do jiu-jitsu, has a beautiful 5.11 store. So if you are a fire department, a law enforcement agency, you now have access to an entire inventory of clothing and equipment in these 5.11 stores. Now, I've talked about the range of shoes they have and how important minimizing weight in our footwear is when it comes to our back health, knee health, etc. I've talked about their unique uniforms that are fitted for either male or female first responders. And then I want to highlight one new area, their CloudStrike packs. For those of you who enjoy hiking, this would even be an application, I believe, for the wildland community. They've created an ultralight pack now with a hydration system built in for rucking, running, or other long-distance events. Now, as always, 5.11 is offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, 15% off every purchase that you make. So if you use the code SHIELD15, that's SHIELD15, at 511tactical.com, you will get that 15% off every single time. So if you want to hear more about 5.11 and their origin story, go to episode 338 of Behind the Shield podcast with their CEO, Francisco Morales. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast, and I apologize for my voice. I've been cheering on the England team during the Euro Cup. But this week I welcome back onto the show a fellow Brit, David Vaux. Now, David spent a career in the London Fire Brigade before transitioning into the world of osteopathy. In our first conversation, which was episode 601, we talked a lot about the fire service, holistic medicine, and some of the challenges for ancient medicine when it comes to the pharmaceutical companies and other industries that we work against. Now, in the second conversation, David comes back onto the show having just written Stronger, How to Build Strength, The Secret to a Longer, Healthier Life. So we discuss a host of topics, from the importance of mobility, hormonal disruption, sleep deprivation, and then we focus on the middle-aged man and woman and how they can forge longevity through strength training. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find.
And this is a free library of 950 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you David Voll. Enjoy. Well, David, I want to start by saying, firstly, it was amazing to see you in London, and we'll get to that in a second. And secondly, to congratulate you on your book. And thirdly, I want to welcome you back to the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks, James. Good to see you, mate. We've chatted a bit, haven't we? I mean, I saw you on the 7-7 in London briefly. Man, you looked tired that day. We can get into that, can't we? It's good to speak to you, and thanks for having me back on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start there. So 7X, for people listening, we a group of Navy SEALs and elite triathletes and some high level scientists went around the world, while the athletes, the runners, did 7 marathons, 7 skydives, and 7 swims. That was the goal, though he didn't manage all those, in 7 continents in 7 days. So I think by the time that we met each other in Hyde Park, which I was just at the other day, I was just came back from London, I don't think I'd slept, you know, apart from a few hours on the plane itself, for 4 or 5 days by that point. And we were getting some sleep. We were lying across the plane seats, but jumping straight into the sleep deprivation and, you know, the career that we both did, having been out for a bit, I was amazed how much it sucked going back into that level of sleep deprivation.
Yeah, I could tell. And, you know, I've been out myself for a while. And, you know, I have sympathy because it did remind me, I think we touched base, didn't we, the week after? And it takes a while. I think as one gets older as well, you know, I think the ability to deal with that and go again, you know, it's a good example, isn't it, of the long-term effects when you are suddenly thrown into that and have to deal with that fatigue level on your body. Both physically and mentally, neurologically, all of the above. The work that the 7X project we're trying to do is so relevant to first responder community.
Absolutely. Well, I remember you brought the book, my book, and I signed it to you. But I didn't sign it to you. I signed it, but I put the wrong name in. I was so tired that I literally signed you a different name. One of the other firefighters that met us there. And then I came to you about an hour later. I was like, oh, give me a book a second. I scratched it out. And I think next to it, I wrote, this is sleep deprivation.
you did, James. But that's, as I say, worthy subject matter, isn't it? You know, you're in the arena right then, weren't you? Actually experiencing sleep deprivation real time. I look forward to seeing the outcomes, you know, of that project. I believe there's going to be a documentary.
Yeah, documentary and like a manual should be getting finished up pretty soon. So we should be telling that story. Pretty amazing human stories woven in that. Well, getting to you. So we talked, I mean, what was that? A year and a half ago now, I think, when we were there, almost a year and a half. And then that kind of spawned the conversation then of writing. Now, I'm still finishing up my book. Your book, Stronger, is already released in the UK, and when this goes out, it will be out in the US as well. So talk to me about the origin story of that. What were you seeing, and then what were you hoping to change by writing your book?
So as you know, I was formerly London Fire Service, and experienced an injury that ended that career, and so then had to reinvent really my whole identity, to be honest with you, having identified as, like, you know, I was very, very focused on tactical fitness. In fact, I had a role as well as operationally in the London Fire Service in physical education as well. So I'd already done a master's degree in exercise physiology and exercise prescription. And so, and that was purely actually to kind of make me better at that job, to make me individually as good as I could be. And then had to pivot in my early 30s, having served 15 years because of the injury. I then went on to become an osteopath and work in private practice. And it took a long time to be able to wean myself off of the medication for pain and inflammation that that I needed at that point. And the thing that I found was breakthrough, pivotal for me, was regaining the ability, the muscle strength around the joints, and to be able to move again with real fluidity. So in a nutshell, when I unpacked that, that was becoming stronger again. Because I had that background of physical education and tactical fitness, strength and conditioning, I wear two hats now. So in clinic, I work with people who have pain and injury, obviously. And then I have that other hat of strength and conditioning. So to answer your question, I was finding myself having the same conversation multiple times a day. And I found, and so I started then, that was a genesis of the idea to actually put my thoughts down, because the majority of people I treated would benefit and have benefited from becoming stronger in some form, in some way. Then I did a deep dive into, well, what are the real benefits of this? Not just the aesthetic or, you know, in my case, the recovery and rehabilitation. But then the prehabilitation piece, you know, the preventative piece that is a bit of a harder sell. So I started, as you know, working for a arthritis charity. And so I head up their therapist team and head up any projects on exercise. And one of them was the UK government healthy aging challenge. So I found myself around about the same time as we met working on a project that was looking to add 5 more quality years to people's lives in the UK by 2035, and they're targeting people in their 70s, realizing that actually that's me we're talking about there. And you know, so I started to really reflect upon those two aspects, so that health promotion, public health piece, and my own clinical work based on my own experiences of knowing what works. And what really hit me was in researching that subject matter for the general population in the UK, yeah, we share a lot of commonalities in terms of exercise levels, people who do and don't exercise as the US, the same kind of demographic. We're very, very closely aligned in terms of levels of obesity, metabolic syndrome, frailty and injuries as well from falling. So all these things were there at my fingertips. And I realized that we're developing a lot of, I'm throwing a lot of money and a lot of good advice at people who are already detrained, who are already frail, already weakened. And I wanted to try to amplify my personal message that I give to people in clinic. Basically, if you're a middle-aged person, come into my clinic. Irrespective of what it is you're coming for, you're going to get this message. So I wanted to give this message to more people and as I say, amplify that message. So I try to write a book for the middle-aged population of the world. It's quite an undertaking because, you know, I genuinely believe that there's an integrity to the message in that if we can all become a little bit stronger, we can avoid the vast majority of things that plague older age that we have become accustomed to thinking are merely symptoms of older age, whereas in fact, they are symptoms of detraining often. And so that was a genesis. That was the challenge. And to write a book, not a clinical book, but write a book for everyone, you know, write a book that I hope people would enjoy and write a book which is full of conversations and examples and pauses for reflection. Because I don't know what you think, James, but any behavioral change that I think works has to start with a friendly conversation. Ideally, a conversation in which you can reflect and think about your own friends, family, and yourself, your own life, and put yourself into that situation. So that was my starting point. Yeah.
Well, going back to the parallel between the UK and the US, we're about the same age. You know, you have a pretty unique lens because you spent, you know, decade and a half in the British Fire Service, and then you moved into osteopathy. What are the reasons why the UK is mirroring the US? Because I've seen it. I literally just went home, and it breaks my heart, because it used to be I'd go home and people wouldn't look like they do in America. And then here we are 20 years later of living in these States. And now when I go home, depending on where I am, you know, if I'm walking through Hyde Park, for example, obviously you've got a more mobile, fitter population that are doing that. But, you know, in the regular, you know, areas now, the obesity is horrendous in the UK. So what have you seen through your unique perspective from when we were young to how we got there today?
That's a great question. And I don't have all the answers, but I have a theory. I think that we've, UK and the US, you know, if you grew up in the, if you become a teenager in the 80s in this country, which you'll probably remember, James, you know, gyms were just starting out, but they weren't gyms like health club gyms. They were kind of scary, dark places, usually, you know, under the, you know, in a basement somewhere, full of kind of, if you were a teenager starting out there, you know, it was a very different experience. And I think the messaging now, I think there's been an invasion I think that social media has hijacked the subject of strength. And the problem is that we have probably overemphasized the importance of cardiovascular fitness over the last 20 years in both the US and the UK. And it's led to something that I call strength hesitancy, in that if you do not have a familiarity with strength training and understanding of it, as we have, because we've had to have industrial levels, you know, in our industries, and you know, you are exposed to these things. And so for me, it became very fluent, like a language, and normal. But for everyone else who potentially hasn't been in the services, been in uniform, or been a sports person, they generally stop strength training and challenging themselves in that particular way, generally shortly after university, if they go to university. Certainly by 30, you're done. Putting yourself in those sorts of challenging situations. However, a lot of people continue to do their cardio fitness training. So I'm not against that at all. In fact, we need to do both. But the message gets lost somewhere there. There's a blank, kind of a blankness that comes across middle-aged people if they haven't had those experiences in their youth or in their formative years, which the majority of us have not. And so it's led to this strength hesitancy and this, you know, getting your 10,000 steps in, etc. All of this is fantastic, don't get me wrong, and it does a hell of a lot of good. But the missing part is strength, because without the strength, you won't be able to protect yourself from sarcopenia and frailty and osteoporosis and older age. You know, as you and I, first responders, have responded to multiple calls where the only reason that person's on the floor is they're not strong enough to get back up. You know, and it's heartbreaking. And I think that is a form of it's a insight into what's going on, because they didn't get the message. So I wrote this book really because it's the book that the generation of our parents didn't get. They didn't get that message. They got the message about 10,000 steps. They got the message about cardiovascular training, as have the current cohort worldwide of middle-aged people. That said, there is a hesitancy, and that's an understandable hesitancy because it's an unknown thing. And strength training, the basic movements that I talk about, have to be trained and learnt. It's not difficult, but you need to be coached through it. And without sounding like a politician, heaven forbid, I wanted to democratize the opportunity for everyone to become stronger in older age. And the time to do that is not when you're 75. That said, you can do yourself a lot of great benefits in your 70s, 80s, and 90s. We know that you can reacquire strength, but it's very difficult to reacquire strength and muscle mass. And the reason I say that is because as a middle-aged person, if we started and continued with consistency, then we are able to build muscle mass functionally and to maintain our strength and power production. That strength and power are all important, to protect our fast twitch muscle fibers. And the reason that that is mentioned is because when we do endurance training, when we walk, when we play, when we do, you know, Ironman, which is objectively very difficult, we are actually leaning into the slow twitch muscle fibers and becoming very, very good at that. But it's not the slow twitch that looks after us in older age. In older age, if you've ever had a parent who has suddenly aged overnight, who has, or a friend or a family member who has suddenly shrunk and slowed down in a short space of time, and that's because of the exponential acceleration of fast twitch muscle fiber loss when we get over 65, 70. And unless we are doing stuff to stimulate those muscle fibers in particular, then they're going to accelerate even further. We can't hedge and we can't offset that loss entirely, but we can do a hell of a lot to slow that decline. And that's the name of the game. You know, we're all going to decline, but you can control it and you can offset a hell of a lot of that with resistance training. So that can be resistance against weight, resistance against your own body weight, and a little bit of faster work as well. So combining that with a little bit of work to do those contractions more quickly, or take up a sport which requires fast movement as well, with the cardio training, is going to protect us in a more complete way. I say get your steps and your reps in, because without one or the other, then you're only doing half the job. And I say the same if people only do strength training. You know, I get them to take up some zone two and some interval training, and consequently, there's someone who concentrates on endurance training. I get them to do that and incorporate in, you know, the very basics really of strength training as well.
I'd love to reverse engineer each of the earlier life phases before we get to middle age, because obviously that's where you're going to unpack, you know, the solutions that you wrote about in the book. When I look back at my son's generation, of course, video games and, you know, social media devices and all these things are contributing, you know, woefully to the breakdown in physicality in some of our children, the increase in obesity and being overweight. So that kind of poor nutrition and lack of movement is very evident. But if we go back to, you know, prior to that, one of the things that's interesting when you move from the States, from the UK to America, is we grew up in an environment where you just played sport, but there were no, you know, elite performance training centers where we were doing plyometrics and all kinds of stuff to be the best footballer you could be. You just play football, and if your school weren't shit, you'd win. And if they were like mine, you wouldn't. But then what I saw is that then, because there wasn't this high level of performance, people seemed to carry on. So you had pub leagues and local leagues. And so it seemed like football and rugby and cricket and some of the other sports and badminton and, you know, all these things, swimming, people kept doing after they graduated from school. Now, conversely, in the States, what they do is they eke performance, but arguably at the expense of longevity of a lot of these young athletes. So you get a super high level, 18, 19, 20, 21, and then, you know, an absolute just drop with all these guys, you know, walking around saying, I coulda, woulda, shoulda, if it wasn't for my ACL, my shoulder, whatever it was. And so even though there weren't the devices and those kind of things, I look back now and you know, I'm trying to kind of see, you and I are existing in a world where a lot of our fellow middle-aged men and women are deconditioned, are, you know, overweight or obese. So starting at us when we were young, what were the factors that worked well for what we're going to talk about? And what were some of the factors inbuilt to culture then that have created this kind of, you know, disease and lack of fitness and strength in our population at the moment?
Well, I think that's a really great question, because, you know, I think if there was a next book in me, it would be the part the first half of the book would be for parents to have conversations with their teenage children. And then the second half of the book would be for teenage children, because there's a lot of toxic masculinity currently, and there's a lot of body dysmorphia on both sides of the gender divide that really doesn't help in terms of putting the message across that strength training, in fact, movement-based practices, strength-based training, cardiovascular training, healthy lifestyle choices, should be a lifelong consistency, an arc over one's life, beginning in school and carrying on and laying those foundations in. And I think you're right that I think often the high watermark of anyone's athletic career is in school or high school or university. Again, unless you then carry through and you play competitive sport, which is often the case. The numbers are pretty terrible still, though. I do occasionally see something popping up on Instagram where there's a 75-year-old or 70-year-old still playing rugby, or you know, the masters sprinters who I think are actually great and really inspirational, still going. But they're the exceptions to the rule, and that's why they're on Instagram, because you know, someone said this is amazing, and they are amazing and should be celebrated. However, what we need is a shift in that becomes the normal. And so, but there's this top heavy thing where, you know, probably near to 90% of people aren't doing the required level of minimum, really required level of strength training. You know, the 150 minutes of moderate exercise or the 75 minutes of intense exercise that most people know about now, those numbers are still pretty poor. But what's even worse, catastrophic really, are the people doing the two sessions of strength training that comes in. This is World Health Organization, NHS, or, you know, across the globe are all saying this, but it's not being done. And it's certainly not being educated. That message is coming out into the middle-aged and older population. It's not being targeted in schools as effectively. So I think there's an educational piece. There needs to be a change in how we educate our children. There are some children who are going to have an eye on a professional sports career. There always will be. However, for everyone else, you know, see, that probably said 0.01% of people who have a professional sporting career. For everyone else, it should be about consistency of health span, you know, and introducing the concepts of health span at an early stage in education. And I think having embedded into that message that you can't have health span, you know, which is not just adding, you know, years to life, but adding life to years, because you don't want to be having a terrible, terrible time and enduring your life. You know, it's got to be a life where you can say yes to things when you're 75, 85. You know, that's really the goal, I think, of what we would define as a good life, you know, to be able to say yes, not to have to endure the end of your life, but actually hopefully enjoying it right up to the end of your life, which is actually where I open the book, because I give an example of someone, you know, a patient I worked with into the mid-90s who did just that. But going back to your question about life stages, we see high water marks in school, depending on which school it is. You know, if it's in the private sector, they tend to get a bit more physical education in this country. If it's state sector, that's a postcode lottery. You then have the university system, which, again, a lot of students go to university and drink. I'm not judging that at all. But, you know, unless you're studying something that's active, then potentially if it's a difficult course, people don't prioritize physical health and well-being. So you then have people stop really in the mid-20s putting themselves into challenging situations unless you have opted for a career in the services. And so you have the vast majority of the population stop challenging themselves in physical ways. You know, so for instance, if you suddenly had to sprint, you know, the amount of people I see in clinic the weekend after a parents' race at school, because they sprinted for the first time in 10 years and their hamstring or Achilles have gone. And laugh, but we all kind of go, oh, yeah, that happened to me. And it's because we stop sprinting, we stop using fast twitch fiber. And then a very good example of that then. So if you have detrained and you've become a cyclist, so your fast twitch fibers have detrained, your slow twitch fibers and your cardiovascular fitness is good, then have to run 100 yards, which you do, but because you haven't got the fast twitch there, your connective tissue, so ligaments, tendons, cartilage, take too much impact and you're injured. And it's as simple as that. So you then become middle-aged. And at middle age, in midlife then, you have to deal with parents and children and career. So it is by far probably the busiest, most stressful time. And a lot of people say, I haven't got the time. And so, again, within the book, I was very careful just to kind of give permission, actually, to be middle-aged, because I'll come back to that point. But we know from some of the experts I've spoken to write the book, you know, epidemiologists and health promotion experts in the UK, that midlife has this key period where the habits and the decisions we make are more profoundly related to our older age. And if we can get into the habit of doing a little bit more strength work, training in, you know, that steps and reps way, then we know from long-term epidemiological research that as an older person, if have you made that decision in midlife, you get a real dividend in older age. And I wouldn't say it's the last chance to make a meaningful change, but I would say that, you know, because what is middle age as well? You know, that's a debate in itself. But that I would say that when you start training like that, the outcome will be as good as the time you have left. So why not start sooner rather than later? Just like a pension, start investing in it, because you're going to need to lean into that pension one day. But I think really the problem is, James, that there's lots of really good information out there. There's lots of good information, but people don't necessarily want to do it. When you Google strength training or becoming stronger as a search term, you know, people like you and me don't pop up. You know, it's kind of what pops up is generally a scantily clad man or woman promoting something, which, you know, a way of working out, which is probably going to leave you injured if you start it when you're middle-aged, and probably going to leave you fatigued and burnt out, which means in the long arc of the next 20 years, which is where my focus is, you're going to be weaker. Because the biggest chapter in my book is how to avoid injury and burnout, because that's the biggest challenge for a middle-aged reader. Don't get injured. Don't overtrain. Don't burn out. Keep turning up, but being consistent in a challenging way, but in a controlled way. So send that message to your body that it's still needed in multiple ways, not just to run or to walk. Because we know there is a causal link, actually, between sending those messages to our deep nervous system and therefore whole self, and there being a dividend 20 years' time. We know there is a causal link. So we just can't really explain why yet, but we know there is one. So, you know, the message is that in the book, I wrote it for middle-aged people, because I didn't really feel like many middle-aged authors had written something that was kind of coherent, in that it's not all about, you know, getting that beach body. It's actually about the next 10, 20, 30 years consistency. And that requires, I feel, a change in mindset. And almost permission to be middle-aged. Now, what I mean by that is, it sounds a bit perverse, but if we want to stop people starting and failing, you know, in their attempts to, in middle-age, to become fitter, stronger, healthier, then we need to give a framework and create a framework within which it's all right to ebb and flow, within which it's all right to gain and regress, you know, to have a good day, a good month, a good year, or a bad one, because that is life, you know, the ebb and flow of life. You know, we talked before about, you know, what it's like not to have a good night's sleep. That's midlife, isn't it? So the problem is that if you do that, if you join something else that's very, very intense, you know, that is based on like quite militaristic training or quite kind of binary, you'll turn up at 4:30 a.m. and you will do this, then what about everyone else who can't do that? What about everyone else who thinks, well, I'll do it, and then you burn out after a month and think of yourself as a failure? So the framework that I propose is something in which you give yourself permission to keep turning up, but you also give yourself permission not to have to, because if you have a period when you're too busy to turn up and then don't, it's not a failure. And, you know, just like eating healthy most of the time, I try to eat healthy most of the time, but there are occasions where I don't. But I know that over the long arc of the next 20 years, I'm going to be eating pretty healthy most of the time, you know, 90, 95% of the time, that will be my life. And therefore, that side of my kind of lifestyle choice is taken care of. Whereas if I try to do some sort of diet that's really, really restrictive, I'd fall off and then probably eat really badly, then fall off and eat really badly. And so 20 years of doing that is going to leave me in a terrible state. So think of strength training in the same way as eating healthy most of the time. If you try to strength train within a controlled but challenging environment that I try to lay out in the book, then you're going to be fine over the next 20 years. And it's trying to get that mindset into people that, you know, you're never going to fail if you're in a system that gives you permission to fail occasionally, because let's face it, life throws its curveballs at you, doesn't it? And I think I just want to have a really honest discussion in the book about that, to say that, you know, I'm no longer that person I was when I was a tactical athlete, you know, when I was, you know, really defined myself as a rower, as a firefighter, as a PT. Not that anymore. You know, I'm a middle-aged dude changed by injury, who's had to reinvent themselves, but still want to have that good arc of life. And I think it's just being realistic, you know, and because the problem is that when people really sell the whole, you know, go hard or go home, well, that's good for business for me, because I'll see you in clinic in a few weeks, you know, because the amount of people who get injured and then end up weaker in the long run is off the charts. So a bit of a rambling answer to that, but yeah, that would be my take on life stages. And I think midlife being the key life stage, which is why I kind of dedicated the book to all midlifers out there, really.
Well, you talked about injury, and I want to unpack that. So I have a litany of injuries, but to be fair, I mean, you know, I was a firefighter, I was a stuntman, I was a martial artist. Some of those injuries are from being punched in the face or falling or whatever it was, but some of them are hands down the result of taking my job seriously coupled with sleep deprivation.
You can never tell. You got punched in the face.
My wife can't shut, my nose goes off to the side. But, you know, but injuries, whatever the origin story, they are such a deterrent to exercise because it hurts. Because your joints move that way. Because, you know, when you press the barbell overhead, you get a sharp pain in your shoulder. Or, you know, you got a deadlift and that old back injury that you rehabbed is still kind of saying, oh, I'm going to happen again. You know, so there's that really kind of scary psychological point to injuries as well. So with that being said, whether it's, you know, the fire service, you want to speak, you know, to our professional or just the average person, talk to me about injuries as we get to middle age, because the thing that I'm realizing now is I'm not trying to get stronger or faster anymore. I'm trying to basically, lack of a better word, unfuck the things that I did to my body for the last 30 years, which will make me faster and stronger. So I am lifting, I am moving, but I'm not trying to, you know, find the envelope anymore. So what are the kind of commonalities with injuries in our age group? And that as a deterrent to the very thing that's going to be the solution.
Well, there's a reason why the injury prevention and understanding pain chapter are the largest in this book, because, you know, this is the biggest challenge. I think especially if I'm trying to sell, you know, it's a hard sell, trying to sell something new and alien to most people, which is strength training. There's a lot of fear and hesitancy around that because it's the unknown. Injury and pain are by far the biggest risk factors, closely followed by fatigue and burnout in midlife, to maintaining a stronger older age. The thing about carrying an old injury, which, you know, we both do, is that you've got to kind of at some point, I think you've got to look yourself in the mirror. And it doesn't matter what other people are doing. Have they had your history? Have they had your life experience? Have they experienced exactly what you've experienced when you've had that injury? And the answer is, of course, they haven't. So firstly, don't try and judge yourself by anyone else. This is a very personal journey. This is your body and your journey. So the second thing to say is that, just like I had to, you have to one day realize that you can't train like a 25-year-old anymore. I did try that a few years ago and ended up just lying in a darkened room for, I could do it, but to lie in a darkened room for a week with a headache because, you know, I just completely annihilated myself, and you don't recover. And the whole thing about overtraining as well, you know, the whole thing, human nature is interesting when it comes to physical conditioning, because you think, and it's still pervasive now in culture, that if I go harder than this, if I do more than is meant to be kind of a safe thing, if I do it more often, then that means I'm going to get a bonus. I'm going to get exponentially, that will equate to me becoming better. No, it really doesn't. What we know is, you know, over the long arc, consistency counts, but not intensity. Consistency and not getting injured count. If you happen to be starting from a point of injury, then there is always an alternative to the movement everyone else is doing. Always an alternative that isn't going to injure you and re-inflame something. Injuries, everyone gets injured. Whoever you are, I don't care who you are, everyone gets injured. You can't prevent all injury. And, you know, you can't prevent aging. But you can offset aging, and you can slow some of the things that are wrongly associated with aging, such as loss of physical condition and in particular strength. So pain, I think, is a subject that people, you know, I think, you know, if you've been lucky enough not to get injured, then great. But understanding what your body's telling you as well, having that kind of biofeedback and leaning into what your body's telling you, you know, pain is there to communicate with us. And I kind of refer to it a little bit like a annoying neighbor at times. If it's there, if we're sat for too long, we become stiff. That's a form of pain. It's feedback. If we work out, we get that burning in our muscles sometimes. So that's a form of feedback. And we kind of can judge when we're experienced, you know, what our body's telling us. Should I adjust that or not? We also have delayed onset muscle soreness, which is DOMS, as you know, which again is an element that we have to lean into and understand what our body is actually telling us. So in that regard, pain is something that I encourage all people to lean into and understand a bit better, because especially if you're dealing with arthritis or dealing, which often middle-aged people are, especially if you're dealing with old injuries, which often middle-aged people are, because understanding what your body's telling you and then experimenting a little bit with what we're trying to do in terms of that movement and finding alternatives will actually help us in the long run realize that, you know, oh, you know, so I did that movement in the water in a pool and it didn't hurt me. And, you know, or, you know, I did an alternative that the personal trainer or the PT at the gym suggested. So there are generally ways of unlocking movements that can help with pain. And what I would say is that, you know, it's impossible in this discussion to give, you know, an answer that would cover all the bases for people that's going to be listening to this. But I do encourage people to try to understand, to try to experiment with what they can and cannot do when it comes to triggering an old response, because the more you can move your body around that response, the better. Now, what I mean by that is that in my own example, if I give you that, I had multiple disc prolapses at the same time. I suffered a industrial, I was on duty, and I had a compression injury, a compression injury. And so that led to early onset of arthritis, something called modic changes, which means that the bone marrow in the vertebral body itself becomes inflamed. And that's something I have to nurse and manage now, you know, 20 years on, every day. I can still be active and strong, but within that, I have my challenges of moving. So I know what works and doesn't work, but on days, even the things that do work sometimes don't. So there is no one fix. The reason I mention that is that back then, when I had my original injury, it was a pretty catastrophic injury. I had nerve root impingement, which means that it's the equivalent of, you know, what a lot of servicemen experience in phantom limb pain, in that I still get raging sciatica sometimes, because the nerve root that I originally inflamed 20 years ago has changed permanently. And even a slight muscle strain at the same level of the spine that was changed permanently will cause it to trigger. I basically got a hair trigger I have to deal with. But that's not to say I haven't found a plethora of ways of moving my body which don't trigger that. And so after a few days of moving generally, you know, in water, I'm a big advocate of, you know, training in pools and moving in that way. I can defacilitate that. I send messages to that spinal segment and my brain that all is well, because my body's moving. It's not mindfulness. It's actually moving my body to send the signal to say all is well. And so that's taken 20 years, James. And, you know, I think what I suggest to people is, if you can find a way of moving, even if it's in an unusual setting or an unusual movement for you, do it, even if you've been previously in pain. Because if you can find a way of moving which doesn't aggravate what you're doing, any movement will more quickly get you to that point that I've just described.
When I look at a lot of the more chronic pain, I'm not talking about getting nailed by a train or, you know, falling off a fire engine and compressing your spine, but the more kind of slow burn injuries, it appears that it's ultimately muscle imbalance and obviously immobility of joints and muscles. So talk to me about the prescriptive element, the healing that you would get with a well-balanced strength training routine around that pain. So healing some of this more chronic pain with exercise.
I mean, any joint, if we take a knee injury, for instance, you know, any joint is only as good as the muscles around it. Even a prosthetic knee, you're only as good as the muscles around it. In my experience in physical education and in clinic, if a person is able to just marginally strengthen those muscles around that joint, they will experience less pain. It's because the muscles don't just work as to move the joints. They work to brace it and girdle it naturally as well. So there's literally a bracing that is there. There's also that signaling as well. So if you are only doing isometric work on a joint that is difficult to move in full range, just an isometric element of strengthening will benefit that joint, as will strengthening the contralateral side, the opposite side. Because as human beings, we are very much set up to be bilateral. You know, we've got two pairs, hands, limbs, etc. So there's this neurological drive to keep us moving. So there's this thing called the crossover effect, which means if this arm is injured, train this one, I'll get a benefit on this one, even though it's in a cast. So in regards to the biological processes of why that would help, well, there's a couple of examples there. But I think for me, the majority of injuries tend to happen when someone has a lack of all-round fitness. And that can be also be cardiovascular fitness as well, because when someone hasn't got the VO2 max cardiovascular fitness, they tend to rely more on their musculoskeletal system and therefore pick up an injury. And then conversely, you know, if they haven't got the musculoskeletal strength, then they'll potentially burn themselves out more quickly. So I think that the way I look at how to prepare, if we're talking about first responders, it's not about being the biggest, the fastest. It's about being consistent. It's about being ready. at any time, multiple times in one shift often. It's about being ready. And that's quite a unique, ask, isn't it, on human physiology. But I think that consistency, I think being mindful also of, yeah, you've got your good program, you know, so let's look at someone who's got a great program. Do they do the mobility piece in there? Do they take care to mobilize, to stretch and decompress, to relax very quickly? Because the sooner you can get into that relaxed parasympathetic state, the more quickly your body will start to replenish and recover. So that brings us on to sleep. You know, sleep deprivation feeds into that. Literally, you'll get less hypertrophy, less recovery if you are sleep deprived, or if you are in a heightened state of anxiety, depression, or, you know, some kind of a neurological arousal. All these things take away from our body's ability to recover, replenish, repair, and to build strength for cardiovascular training. So it has to all be there, and that's a challenge, especially over a 30-year career. I think if you have a knowledge of what works for your body, if you've trained for a while, then the thing to do is to, I think, we're going back to middle age again. When you get to middle age, I would say maybe change gears a bit. You have to give yourself permission to change gears, James. If we're talking about avoidance of injury, if you continue to train like you did when you're 25 and you're 55, you're going to get injured. And you're not going to be training like that at 75. At some point, you're going to have to change gears. And I always encourage people to change gears when it's their choice, not when they have to, because there's been an injury. You know, it's the old fable, isn't it, where someone has a fire, then puts a fire alarm in afterwards. You know, the barn door when the horse is bolted, you can name probably several others. Make the choice before you have to in an ideal world. I call it the great gamble, because the amount of people who, including myself up until actually really diving into this subject matter, you know, we train and we won't change our training until we're injured and have to, and you're just hoping for the best. And then when you get injured, then you think, actually, yeah, I've had that niggle for ages and I didn't stop. And then it became something more and more, and then I got injured. Whereas actually, if you have that niggle, lean into it, understand it, lighten your load, come back to it in a month, train again, train up, train around the movement. But don't just keep going with that niggle, because if you do, then there's a high expectation that in 20 years you'll be weaker. And that's a tragedy to me, because a lot of people have trained and they get injured in midlife for this very reason. They might have trained for quite a long time and then get injured and that's it. And you know, I see a lot of this when people retire as well, you know, when they had a certain regime and then they retire and their system detrains quite quickly because they stop moving in the same way. And, you know, that's a tragedy because, but all that investment in time and effort and you're still going to end up weaker. I had an interesting conversation with a journalist a few months ago talking about this project, and she was talking to me about, you know, the movements in the book, and I and she said that her husband knew she was talking to me that day, and he'd asked her to ask a question, and the question was, he hasn't done anything. He's 45 and hasn't done any. He's literally didn't do anything from school. His work's been quite sedentary, a little bit overweight. He's thinking about taking up some strength training and some cardio training, and taking the advice that I kind of tried to amplify out there. And I said, great, so what's the question? He said, well, you know, is it too late? And I said, no, it's not too late. This book was for him, because the lady who was interviewing me was a journalist who trained all her life. So you had really binary, you know, one and the other. But I said that if she was to stop right now, and he was to start, because they're both about 45. At 75, he wins, because you cannot rely on former glory. It's gone. You know, you get a detraining effect. Whoever you are, doesn't matter. You cannot rely on former glory of former physical fitness or former levels of strength to protect you in 30 years' time when you're 75. So the husband, if he starts now and is consistent and sensible over the next 30 years, wins the aging game, because it is, I think, a game in that regard. It should be looked at as that. And she was shocked. She said, well, yeah, but, you know, I think, you know, she was and still is a very active, very strong, very fit woman. He wins. Give it a few years, he wins. If it continues, he definitely wins the aging game. And it's because there's this detraining effect in the nervous system, in the muscular system. I think I mentioned earlier in this conversation that we know that 75-year-old, 85-year-olds can reacquire strength if they've been detrained for some number of years, because there's a neurological component to strength, but they can't reacquire the muscle mass. And, or certainly not in the way that one would think if you can regain strength. So the reason I bring that up is because strength and muscle are closely related, and we need a bit of both. We don't want to be bodybuilders, you know, but we don't want to be powerlifters. We ideally want to be somewhere in the middle. So we get functional hypertrophy. We get functional strength in movements that we're going to experience in our lives moving forward, which is how I try to break up those movements. And the reason we want the muscle mass is because it helps with pain, bracing the joints, as I mentioned. It also acts as a natural repository of amino acids, which are, you know, essential to life. You know, every hormone, biological, cellular action are actually dependent on our repository to be able to do that, to be able to repair, replenish those cells, make hormones, etc. If they're not there, then our immune system falls off a cliff as well, because the muscular skeletal system, our muscle mass, should be, and I believe is now being viewed by more people, as an immune organ with definitely an immune function in its own right, which again explains why those older relatives who we see suddenly shrink and slow and lose postural kind of, you know, their postural ability to function in life, also lose their ability to respond to the common cold, because that repository isn't there anymore. So, you know, we need to start thinking literally about age like that. And so, you know, if you'd spent 30 years from middle age maintaining what muscle you build, doing what you can to build functional muscle mass and strength, working on those fast twitch fibers, which are important to save us from trips and falls, for that quick foot readjustment when we trip, or to pull ourselves up from the floor when we're on the floor, as well as that repository of the ability within our amino acids to replenish, repair our cellular function, then we're going to be in great shape compared to the person who stops in midlife. And it's that binary.
When you talk about the hormonal impact of, you know, the loss of muscle mass, to me, it mirrors what we see in our profession. And obviously, you know, there's a massive element of sleep deprivation that's contributing to that. But there are men's clinics opening up everywhere where I live now, and it's all TRT. And I actually partner with a company called Transcend who are doing it right. They do phenomenal blood testing. They offer peptides if you just need to boost your own levels a little bit, and then TRT for people who truly are devoid of the production and need to actually have it exogenously. But, you know, conversely, sleep is going to help, especially these younger firefighters. Muscle mass is going to help not just firefighters, but the general population in, you know, in a country where, like I said, they peaked at 2021 and have been sedentary for the next 20 years. So just kind of unpack that a little bit more, the relationship between physical health and, you know, muscle health and the very sex hormones that we rely on for longevity.
Yeah. So, you know, obviously half the population, over half the population are female. And so one of the biggest kind of dangers, obviously, to the menopause is that loss of skeletal muscle mass and tendency for osteoporosis, osteopenia. And again, with men, as you mentioned, you know, testosterone levels dropping. These hormonal drops, if you look at a graph, you know, male and female tend to do that. Whereas, and that's if they're not making the kind of right healthy lifestyle exercise choices, resistance training, strength training, if you can, then you can blunt the curve slightly. But that slight blunting of the curve means a hell of a lot to your quality of life in older age, a hell of a lot. So in terms of TRT, what I would say, and so this country, it's a very different system. There are longevity clinics more and more popping up. They're calling them longevity clinics. And, you know, it's an exciting time to look at the research at the moment, because my mission really was to democratize a stronger older age. I wanted to talk about things that everyone can do that aren't really based upon having the money to go to one of these things, or, you know, to be able to actually see a really good doctor. Because, you know, I mean, personally, you only want to be seeing a real expert when you're dealing with hormonal replacement. My point being that I think that anything medical like that should be considered if you really do have a deficiency, and should be medically advised. But when it comes to the benefits that are there for everyone, then it really is quite simple that the vast majority, I think something like in the UK, 7% of men and 4% of women are only that amount actually currently strength training, and therefore are maintaining that muscle mass. And so the numbers are so bad that I don't really entertain people or don't advise them seeking those kind of medical interventions, certainly in the UK. And I would probably stand by that in the US as well, until they've actually done the basics, or, you know, try to lose a bit of weight in a healthy way, slowly. Try to gain some strength in a healthy way, slowly. Try to get some cardiovascular fitness into your life without injuring yourself, slowly. If you've done that and you've done all those things and you're still struggling for whatever reason, then I think the medical approach is absolutely valid. I really do. But I think the reality is that unless you do that, I think you're robbing yourself of the opportunity to do it naturally, because there's so much wisdom in our bodies that, you know, we're literally rewarded with feel-good hormones, you know, if we get it right. You know, there's so much wisdom that if we just commit to 6 months of trying to change something, it can benefit. I know I've seen one of your posts ages ago when you cut alcohol out, you change your sleep routine. This is after you interviewed a sleep expert. And you shared your hormone, I think your testosterone results, and they went up. Something as simple as that. You know, you didn't have to do anything other than just kind of practice some lifestyle changes. And that's my point, in that it works. It's not sexy, is it? It's not, you know, it's not wrapped up as a package and sold to you. It's just actually a bit of practice, a bit of knowledge, and a bit of wisdom that you lean into that's been there for millennia, that you can actually feel when you're doing something right, just as you can feel when you're doing something wrong, right? You know, it's there's that wisdom in the body. So, I mean, who's to say? When it comes to, you know, the boundaries and the our knowledge at this point in terms of longevity, in terms of the best practice, we just don't know. Irrespective of what people might say in science, we just don't know truly yet, because we can't put a control group who do nothing with another group who do one thing, and another group who have the exercise regime and the medical advice or medical intervention, because that's unethical. We've got to look at things. We've got to look at epidemiological research. We've got to look back and try and learn lessons from that. And we've also got to kind of like look at the experience of people who work with people in this field. So there are some implicit relationships that are there. We just can't definitively say how they're there. Like, for instance, I mentioned, we know that in midlife, you know, certain movements and certain practices leads to better outcomes for health generally in older age. So things like grip strength, leg strength, there is a causal link. We just can't quite nail down exactly why yet, but it's there. So we shouldn't stop doing it. just because we don't know exactly how it happens. We don't want to do a control blind trial where we put a load of people who detrain and become sarcopenic and osteopenic and risk of frailty, because that's unethical, as I say. So coming back to your original question, it's an exciting time, because I think within our lifetime, we will know more. I think within our lifetime, there probably will be a product that can accessible to the general population without too much expense, that can potentially do something to the rate of cellular aging. But right now, you know, it's important, therefore, to stay in shape, right? This, you don't want to be a frail 70-year-old, you know, having to retrain first before you can even be considered for some intervention. Be kicking ass when you're 75, 85. Because probably, you know, if something does become more accessible in that longevity sector, or there's more understanding of how the long-term effects of these hormones work, if you're in good shape anyway, you're probably not going to be bothered by it, mate. You know, I think you're probably going to be thinking, it's working. What I'm doing is working. I don't want to do that. So I've got an open mind to that. I think, you know, let's see. But I think stay in shape, so you're around, you're in the game when things are becoming, you know, more, you know, becoming clearer.
You touched on the body's innate ability to not only reward itself when we're doing right, but just the innate ability to heal, the innate ability to thrive. And I think this is, you know, you mentioned earlier about what is middle age. You know, my grandparents were 99 and 105, basically, when they both passed. So what I see middle age, being a glass half full kind of a guy, is I'm not even there yet at 50 years old. I got a couple of years before I match my grandmother's. But, you know, again, it's also the health span, as you touched on. When you did your research and you looked at cultures around the world, because I shared a Haitian man not too long ago, 80, I forget now, 3, absolutely ripped, still working in the sugar canes, I think is what he was doing. And he made a mention of he didn't retire because he didn't want to be a liability to his children. But this man would have been, you know, would have challenged anyone in the gym. Any, you know, 18, 20-year-old, it was phenomenal watching him. And so I think we have such a skewed perspective on what 50, 60, 70 even looks like. So outside of, you know, the Western kind of modernized culture, when you look at more indigenous cultures around the world, obviously factoring in, you know, the disease and all that other stuff, but when given, you know, the diet that they should be getting and free from disease, what are you seeing as far as ability in, you know, middle age onwards in some of these less corrupted tribes?
Yeah, great question. Huge tolerance for life, you see, with people, you know, the blue zones around the world. And I think it's because somewhere along the line, you know, they culturally, decisions were made that I think they get benefits from multi-generational living. They get benefits from being an elder, not an older person, but being an elder. They feel valued. They have community. They don't stop necessarily working and retire. They just carry on in that community. I think it's very interesting. I think they can't quite distill the golden pill of the blue zones, but certainly looking at, you know, some of the cultures. So for instance, in Japan, they're not going to the gym in Okinawa, mate. You know, but they are doing multiple squats a day because their desks are on the floor. They eat on the floor. They socialize on the floor. So on a very basic level, you know, they're getting their leg strength in there. People working in the fields are getting their leg and hand strength there. I'm not saying it's not kind of a hard and sometimes quite brutal. There's that often thing. You have to realize that there was a reason why 100 years ago there was a lower life expectancy, because people were overworking, overtraining, a form of overtraining, that raising their body inflammation, then dying younger, potentially. But, you know, what is middle age? I mean, I, for the purpose of the book, I said 35 to 65, but it's a very, as you say, if you've got relatives, longevity in the family, living to their hundreds, then, you know, what does that mean? I mean, I would say middle age is you're no longer young, but you're not yet old. And the not yet old bit is still very much up for grabs. You know, they're no longer young. That's gone. That boat has sailed, right? But I think the not yet old bit is the interesting bit, because I intend to be not yet old for as long as I could possibly be. And I think that's what I'm encouraging people to do is, I'm not yet old. I want some of that. You know, let's not yet be old. And that is done, obviously, by a whole plethora of lifestyle stuff that should aim to deliver you as a stronger you in 30 years. That does obviously include strength training, also includes nutrition, includes sleep, relaxation, happiness, all these things. But without the base building blocks of actually doing the physical practice, then you're not going to have it. And so, yeah, it's for me, it's about just having a mindset that I'm not yet old, and in whatever that means to everyone. We might look old, but we might not yet be old physically. And it's sending messages to your body and your nervous system that you're still needed. You know, if we decide to retire and sit, then good luck, because you'll become very good at sitting, and you're sending a message to deep cellular self that you're no longer needed to do challenging things. And guess what? You lose your fast twitch fibers. You know, you can no longer, when asked, do challenging things. And what does that mean? What does that life look like? That will look like a life that's defined by the four walls you find yourself sitting in. And so I see strength training in a controlled way, so regular controlled strength training, as not only building that strength in your musculoskeletal system, but sending a very important message to your deep cellular self that you're still needed, you still need to show up, and so stick around. And it's the fast twitch fibers and the relationship between them and the nervous system that you're telling that to. You're asking that relationship to stay fast, and you're asking those fast twitch fibers to stick around. If you lose that, if you do not practice that in any way, then you know you might be running, you might be cycling, you might be swimming, and it's all great, but you'll be losing that fast twitch part of what could have been there. And in terms of longevity, fast twitch is golden. And so you know, that basically summarizes what I'm trying to tell people, really, in that, you know, if you're only doing half the job if you don't pay attention to the fast twitch fiber. And to do that, you need to do something challenging and controlled. Don't do something crazy. Do something challenging and controlled for the next 20 years, regularly, but giving yourself permission to have good and bad periods. But as long as you return to that practice, you'll be all right. And the thing to say, James, is we're not going to keep doing personal bests all the time for the next 20 years. We might have already peaked. I don't know. You know, I equate physical strength as, like, you know, when you're climbing a rope, but you probably did have to do this in training. I did in training. You have to climb a rope and then, you know, ring a bell at the top, then climb back down, then do it again. Physical strength, you know, you might get halfway up the rope and that represents your high watermark of strength. Now, you're all on a rope. There's a line of you all on a rope. And so you're in the middle on that rope. And then hormonally in midlife, you might come down a few hands down. And then you look around you and, you know, it's all pretty similar. And then the people who decide not to do any physical practice, such as strength training, they go down that rope even further and faster than you. And eventually in older life, they hit the ground. Literally, we know people hit the ground in a metaphoric way, in a physical way. Whereas if you started in midlife to come down, but actually the rate at which you come down that rope is controlled and you don't actually hit the ground when you're older, then good. You might be a few inches off the ground, but you haven't hit it. And you're controlling that descent via your physical practice. And then we're on to a winner. And it's that simple. That's the way I see aging.
That whole philosophy of not yet old. I do the 3-4-3 hero challenge every year. And I think there's a division that's like 40 and above, and I'm 50 now. And every single year I enter into the regular one, the younger one. And I've got a teammate who is in that age group, but he said to me before, you know, if you did the other division, you might be on the podium. I'm like, but it's not about that. It's about showing the young firefighters that at 50 years old, I'm not yet old. I can still show up in bunker gear, grab ladder, grab hose, grab people, and make it happen. It's walking the walk. And I think where that's powerful is, like you said, the psychological point of view. Because there's a lot of people wearing uniform that are a liability, that can't do the job anymore, you know, and that's, you know, they know it. They know damn well in their heart of hearts if they can or they can't. So I think that, you know, it's less about, oh, but I want a trophy for my shelf, and more about, I want to stay in that mindset where I can. Am I going to be as fast or as strong as the 18-year-old? Probably not. But am I still able to move those tools that I need to for my job, or roll with someone, you know, half my age on the jiu-jitsu mat or whatever it is? Yeah, you know, and it's at, you know, 80% of what I could do before, but I'm still doing it with this younger group of people and still feeling younger myself, rather than going, well, you know, I'm 50 now, I'm going to take up golf. You know, so I think that there's a huge, very powerful psychological point of that, leaning into that not old, especially if you're in a profession where your physicality is a life-saving tool.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that's the exactly right. And I think you summarize it perfectly in that, you know, you're doing probably 80% of what you were doing or would have done when you were 35, 30. But it doesn't matter. You're still in the game. You're still in the arena doing challenging stuff, sending that message to yourself. And, you know, that's my metaphor was, you're coming down that rope. We all are. But you're coming down more slow than the dude who's taken up golf. That's for sure. 100%. You know, person who's taken up golf is probably already on the floor. They just don't know it yet because, you know, they haven't had that medical event. So that's perfectly right. I think you've got to be sensible. You've got to be give yourself permission to be middle-aged, but still turn up and do challenging things in a controlled way. You know, I think as at a middle age, you know, in middle age, and, you know, talking about middle age, you know, I mean, in the UK, generally, if a firefighter joins at 18, they've left the job unless they're a very senior officer by, you know, early 50s. They're retired. And maybe 55. That's the worst thing you can do is to stop any kind of regime you've had. The best thing you can do is, now that you don't have to put yourself in very sketchy, physically dangerous situations, if you are lucky enough to have come through that and can still move reasonably well, then what a tragedy if someone then injures themselves doing something that's meant to be recreational, finally, you know? So at that point, I say change gears, build upon that base and that knowledge you've got, and then keep going. But don't try and injure yourself. You know, try and have a mindset on the far horizon to really look after yourself, and not just yourself, actually. You know, I think being strong and independent is the biggest gift you can give to your family when you're older. And, you know, we're all in the same boat, again, globally. You know, we're an aging, top-heavy population. So, you know, I mentioned that in somewhere in the book, I can't remember exactly where it was, that, you know, we all die, don't we? And then we die again when someone stops saying your name. But then there's a time before that, I think, if you're unlucky enough to lose that physical independence because, frankly, you've come to that point sooner than you needed to, or that's a tragedy. That's another tragedy. That's another death, really. And when we're middle-aged, we've got quite a binary decision to make. You know, do you spend the next 30 years playing golf and slowly dying? Or do you spend the next 30 years being as strong as you can within sensible control limits and saying yes to everything, you know, competing in those things that you want to compete in, giving yourself permission to be middle-aged and compete, you know, doing the 80% that 21-year-olds you would have done, but you're still in the game. And, you know, the challenge, James, is to try to turn that narrative into not just a couple of people having a chat about it, because I know you and I, touch wood, will be still in the game in 20 years' time. And we'll be unusual for that. You know, we need to kind of make it the usual thing that, you know, people are still in the game, get this message that you can still compete, you can still put yourself in challenging situations, you can still sprint, you know, you can still lift and lower and press heavy things, but maybe not as heavy as you did when you were in school. And that isn't a failure. That's a success.
I want to hit one more topic and then we'll go to the strength training principles that you talk about in the book. But one of the things I think a lot of us see, certainly in America, because we do so much EMS as well, is the impact of osteoporosis, especially on our older women, and the number of hip fractures and pelvic fractures and things that are, you know, not just an emergency, but more often than not life-ending, because they lose their mobility. And then, you know, psychiatric or psychologically, that's kind of like the end for them. So I remember being in University of North London doing exercise physiology, and there was one slide I remember to this day, and it was a cyclist. And they said that the only place in this study they found an increase in bone density was in their wrists, where they were leaning on the handlebars as they were cycling, because their legs were going in a circular motion. And so you think about the messaging, you know, when it comes to bone strength that we were raised on, it was drink milk, you know. And then now, as you kind of carry on down the educational path, you're like, no, it's impact. You kind of, you know, you shock the bone and it rebuilds a little bit stronger. You shock the bone. It doesn't have to be impact. Impact, obviously, strength training, tension from that muscle can do the same thing. So talk to me about the imperative importance for strength training when it comes to bone density, and then obviously the downstream effect of the lesser likelihood of a life-threatening injury like that.
Yeah, so you're right that we're always taught about impact. And so all the runners and joggers out there say, great, I'm getting that. I'm good. I'm all good. But you're only, again, you're only doing half the job, because yes, there's the bone itself remodels more strongly, having experienced impact. But there's also the fact that osteoporosis and sarcopenia, which is loss of lean skeletal muscle mass, is closely associated. So you don't have one without the other. So conversely, if you maintain your skeletal muscle mass, you're much less likely to have osteoporosis. And it's because in the act of maintaining that lean skeletal muscle mass, you have been lifting, lowering, pushing, pulling, gripping something with resistance. That compression that your body feels, the long bones especially feel when you're lifting, lowering, pushing, pulling something, directly stimulates specialist deep bone cells to lay down more bone. And that doesn't happen in the same way as if you're just getting impact. So you need a little bit of impact, and that can be something like bouncing, can be tennis, you know, boxing drills, anything like that, running. But you need that other compression and then relaxation of the bones to stimulate that very specific bone cell adaptation. So yes, you're doing a lot of good with impact, but to cover the bases, to avoid osteoporosis and sarcopenia in one go, do some strength training. You know, it really is like medicine. So again, I'm a big fan of bones. I'm an osteopath. I should be. And you also see that varied movement in life leads to beautiful lines. If you look at a bone or diagrams of a bone, in a bone of someone who's fractured the head of the femur, generally speaking, if you look at the trabecular lines, which are the lines of stress that are laid down through life, you can kind of tell how active or not or inactive that person was. If you look at a bone of a healthy person, the trabecular on their bone, beautiful spiral lines, you know, like real kind of architectural, beautiful lines and spirals that spiral around the head of the femur. They've lived a life full of movement. They haven't fractured the head of the femur when they've fallen, you know. So I kind of went on a bit of a segue there. But basically, yeah, to lift, lower, compress and relaxation, that movement, compression and release of the bone stimulates a bonus, if you will, of strengthening bone in a way that sheer merely impact will not.
Beautiful. Well, I mean, this is such an important, you know, conversation, especially I love the way you were talking about seeing that simply on the bone itself, like the rings of a tree. So when it comes to my exercise journey, you know, early on, I was running around a farm, you know, copying Rocky on the exercise bike and punching dead cows and stuff. It wasn't dead cows, but and then it progressed to, you know, the typical English sports center, which was all the bodybuilding machines. And, you know, it was funny because when I was 21, I was a lot weaker than I was when I was, you know, 40, to be honest. But then I got into CrossFit, and absolutely life-changing for me. You know, is it a perfect system? No, but it served me extremely well as a firefighter, and as a fighter as well. I mean, on the mats, it was amazing. But what I discovered is it wasn't so much that it was getting me injured, but the injuries in general that I was accumulating weren't getting better from that practice specifically. And I was pretty diligent, and I was doing some other stuff as well, but it just wasn't really kind of, you know, moving the needle back to where it should be. And recently I've been doing a programming called Wolf Brigade, and their whole philosophy, and their kind of ex CrossFit guy that developed it, they lent right back into the strict movements. So there's a lot of kettlebell pressing, there's some of the barbell movements, you know, squatting and deadlifting and bench. But then, you know, there's Turkish get-ups, there's a lot of mace work, there's a lot of strict pull-ups. And it feels incredible. And the mace work, I can feel kind of, you know, forcing my shoulder, for example. I think I either separated my shoulder or broke my collarbone years ago doing stunts day 3. So I couldn't tell anyone. So I had to just do it, you know, get on with it and suck it up. But obviously it heals in the wrong way. So what I have seen is it's not like, oh, I'm too old for CrossFit anymore. But rather than wait for an injury, for me, my analysis was, all right, my prior injuries do not seem to be progressing in this system anymore. And so I just, you know, moved over to a different philosophy that is slower, that is more strict, that is a lot of compound pressing and a lot of getting off the floor. You know, the elevator sit-ups, the Turkish get-ups are beautiful. Just, you know, to keep someone being able to get off the floor, and then on a jiu-jitsu mat to drive your opponent off you with the kind of strength that most people don't have. So talk to me about the middle-aged male and female, you know, average member of the society or athlete, and how in the book, you know, the principles and philosophies shift slightly for that particular age bracket.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the book, I tried to write the book to represent the equivalent of a couch to 5K, but for strength training. Because I'm a big fan of anything that gets you doing any form of resistance, strength, weight training. But my experience in clinic, and also just kind of the research, bears me out in that if you go too soon into those things, you're going to get injured. And so again, long term, you're weaker, more at risk of health events in older age. So it was very much, the challenge was how to take the average detrained middle-aged population from literally no experience to being able to then walk in the door or Wolf It or a CrossFit gym and then carry on their journey. So this is what this book represents. It's like a feeder, if you like, to hopefully a lifetime of other choices. I don't really recommend how after that. Oh, I do. I give examples of how you can carry on doing something similar, or you have choices. I do try to encourage people to keep the journey moving in a way that kind of you experience a variation as well, which is very important in the long term. But you're right that you brought up the importance of compound. I think what I try to do is I broke down, and you know, I'm not the first person to do this because this information has been around, you know, since the ancient Greeks, frankly. But what I try to do is break it down into recognizable movements, you know, all compound or grip strength movements that you're likely to experience in life moving forward, that it's a very good idea to be strong in moving forward. And I weighted them against, and what I've weighted, I put the importance of them, how many of that particular movement in was weighted against, I felt the importance of that particular movement in terms of risk in the future and potential benefits that we know can be gained. So for instance, there's two grip exercises that I suggest because we know there's a causal link between grip strength and older age health. We also know that as we age, we lose more ability to maintain muscle mass and leg strength in older age, as opposed to upper body strength. So there's more leg stuff in there. So the movements that the foundational 10 are, you know, are very much weighted against risk and benefit. They're all compound, apart from grip, which tend to be a bit more isometric. but the way I look at it is we're working on functional hypertrophy, not just hypertrophy. We're working on multiple muscle groups in a movement across a joint that we are likely to experience in life. And therefore, it's a very good idea to be strong in that movement. And in terms of how to frame it, this practice really, my program, if you start very unexperienced or detrained, take about 12 weeks to do. You can dip in and out of it. If you don't want to start there, there are other options. You can do other things in your daily practice of just doing things that I call strength snacking, which is isometric stuff and stuff around the house or at work. You can leverage, you know, your normal life to get stronger, which again, it was really, really great fun to write, because what I'm trying to do is make this accessible to everyone. Not everyone's going to want to do, you know, a 12-week program or any program, but what they might be open to is something that, you know, when the kettle's boiling or you're waiting for the toilet to pop, do a wall sit or hold a plank, or, you know, you don't need any equipment. You know, you can be as simple as that. And if you give me the person who does that against the person who does nothing, the person who does those daily strength snacks is going to win in the long run. So, yeah, it's there's no one program fits all. But I've tried my best to create a framework, as I mentioned earlier in this chat, that gives you permission to be middle-aged, gives you permission to come in and out of it. And as long as most of the time you're in it, then you'd be just fine in 20 years. If you miss a few months or a few weeks, start again slowly, build up, go again. We need to allow ourselves to progress, regress, to improve and pause, because that's life. And I think once we get our heads around that, then we're more likely to come back to it. If you have had a delay, you've moved house, you've been ill, someone you know has been ill, you've missed training for a week or 2 weeks or a month, whatever, you've been injured, whatever. It gives people permission to live your life in that way, but still come back to it, I think.
I literally had to press pause while I was writing this book. You know, I mean, literally, I went to jiu-jitsu, I think, once a week and didn't do strength training. I'm just like, I need to prioritize for it. I think it wasn't too long. It was 10, 12 weeks maybe. And I trained, you know, since I was a kid. So it wasn't like, you know, I have these massive periods of not working out in the past. But it was just one of those things where I'm like, mentally, I need to get this done, you know. And so I hit pause for a while and I'm just back in again, swallowing my pride, being sore and, you know, getting back into a yet another routine, but there's no guilt, just like you said, because I'm like, this is more important at this point. I'm not going to suddenly be 400 pounds if I just prioritize writing for 10 weeks, you know. But I think it's the same with alcohol, drugs, you know, your nutrition, yeah, whatever it is. If you've fallen off the proverbial wagon, guilt and shame have no place. All they're going to do is keep you on the ground next to the wheels. You know, you stand up, you go, all right, well, that was then, all I have is now, and you climb back on, you know. But knowing that there will be another thing, and I told you about what happened to my family today, that derailed my morning, you know. But, you know, it is what it is. I'm actually about to go to the gym after this, but had I not, I'd be like, all right, well, this happened today, I'm going to go walk the dog and get some exercise and some sunshine. But that totally changed the trajectory of my day. But there doesn't need to be any guilt or shame. You just have to, you know, as you said, go, look, I say in nursing, you know, it's trending, or in medicine, you know, is the patient getting better or is the patient getting worse? Well, if you actually zoom in on that line, it's got all these peaks and valleys, you know, because it's not a straight line. But if overall you're heading in that good direction, that's what's important.
Yeah, that's so true. And, you know, that's basically the rationale for creating the framework that I did, in that, you know, I'm trying to help people get to that mindset that you have, James, and that I have, in that in the long run, you know, we're trying to blunt that curve for, and avoid, you know, bad outcomes in the future that as yet we aren't aware of. So if you give yourself permission to live your life, to not feel like a failure if you, you know, fall off the wagon or fall off the training regime or fall off, you know, a program. The key is picking the right program, James, you know, having the right kind of attitude. I think the key is being realistic and, as I said, checking your ego and understanding that we're in midlife. My message was quite similar. In midlife, we're all about you know, not just adding the years, but adding life to those years. And that is a very different proposal to getting fit for the beach or looking good in a t-shirt. You know, this is a very different conversation. You might still get those two things with it, but the priority shouldn't be about that. The priority should be about functional movements that don't get you injured, that are challenging, but regular. But if something happens, like we discussed, then as long as you keep coming back, and honestly, the beauty of it is it kind of takes the pressure off because you think, well, I've got the next, I'm not just talking about next year, I'm talking about the next 20 years, because we all know the short-term benefit of crash diets and things done fast generally don't last, right? So building something over the long term, becoming fluent in a new skill over time always pays off. And it has to start with your mind, though. And so, you know, the mindset you just described so beautifully, the one that I'm trying to lay out in my rationale, is exactly where the middle-aged person who's actually serious about the long-term health, who wants to stay healthy for whatever reason, should start to consider. Yeah.
Well, I'm not just saying this because we're friends. The book is incredibly well written. You did absolutely blend the science that's needed behind it with, you know, the ability to write to the average person like me, you know, like they always say firefighter proof. That's what we need to do. That's why my books are always really thin. but you know, but it's so important. And then obviously you've got the exercises in the back as well. So the book is Stronger, How to Build Strength, The Secret to a Longer, Healthier Life. People listening all over the world, where can they find this online? And are there any other places?
Yeah, so it's available online, all good booksellers. I think it's being launched in the US territories in July, which is exciting. So Amazon, we can include a link to the US Amazon page for this, I'm sure. So yeah, but if you just Google that, it will come up. Yeah, so, and thank you for saying that. It's very kind, James. You've been part of this in a way, because what people probably don't know is that you and I have both been writing parallel to each other, different genres, but we would occasionally meet up and talk about the process in our little writers group, which was great fun and very supportive. So thank you for that time you gave me as well.
Yeah, I wish I could be more supportive. I remember I was just so overwhelmed that I don't think I was that valuable as far as my experiences. I mean, the first one.
It's good to talk though, isn't it? It's good just to talk about it, because it's quite a writing anything, even if it's first, second time, it's quite an undertaking. And it's something that, let's just say that, you know, if speaking to someone else, even if just chatting about how it's not going well, makes it less scary, because, you know, it's quite an undertaking. And so, yeah, that was great. That was great, being in that little group.
So where can people find you online, social media or websites?
So yeah, I really only do a couple of social media things these days. So I do Instagram. So it's David_Vaux, and I'm also on LinkedIn. So yeah, probably Instagram is the best place to find me. Probably going to be doing a little bit more on YouTube as well this year. But yeah, you can find me if you just Google my name and the book. I'll come up. As say Instagram as well, we can include the link to that as well, James. And I think the next steps for this project, potentially, I'm looking at is potentially to digitalize some of the assets in the book. But also, I'm very keen on the idea of, you know, writing a book was very new, and I'm also quite keen on exploring the idea of a documentary, that kind of lays out the chapters of the book and speaking to some interesting people that I spoke to in the book. And yeah, so that hopefully will be the next chapter of this crazy journey.
Brilliant. Well, I want to say thank you so much. I mean, the first conversation was phenomenal. Obviously, we dove a little more into the firefighter side as well. But I mean, there's so many people listening that are either in that age bracket now or probably not too far from that age bracket. Some may be uber athletes, some may be realistically in the best shape when they were in the academy and looking to get back on that wagon again. But there's, you know, I think between the people in the professions that are responding to citizens and the citizens themselves, this is a really important conversation. The long-term benefit of proactive nutrition, strength training, and mobility on our longevity. So I want to thank you so much for such a great conversation again and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
James, it's always a pleasure, mate. And anytime, and hope to see you in person sometime soon.